guys spare a bagel? Help me buy a bagel from the little stand.
What does it take to get the rich world here in America and the West interested in the poor world?
If you guys have any leftover bagel remnants, that would be delicious.
I'm Nick Fraser, and this is a program on the BBC World Service, which we've decided to call Poor Reporting. A look at how poverty is reported and what it takes to get people engaged in an issue which affects a billion people around the globe. I've been a reporter and a producer for most of my life, and for the past 3 years, I've been overseeing a project called Why Poverty, a multimedia event aimed at 500 million viewers in partnership with more than 60 broadcasters around the world. I'm here in New York to launch the series. I've been forced to get interested in the way poverty is covered in the media. Do we do a good job? Do we do a bad job? Do we do any sort of job at all? And what better place to be than the Big Apple, where brokers trade billions on Wall Street, and which is one of the media nerve centers of the world.
It was just gigantic.
It was humongous.
Enormous. Huge.
Most people who watch television these days are fickle.
In just a couple of years, you've got a system that's making it perhaps too easy.
Hopping from one channel to the next.
Every 2 weeks, I have to count the birds that are on the island.
Nowhere more so than in the United States, where there are thousands of programs to choose from.
Please welcome Joan London.
What are we looking for? Those in the industry will tell you it's entertainment, pure and simple, and that we don't want to hear about the world's problems or any talk about putting things right. So, let's suppose we're pitching the idea for a series about poverty anew. A nervous program maker meeting television executives in the lobby of a trendy hotel in downtown Manhattan.
I'd have a few questions. First is, you say there's a lot of people want to run it. Does that mean that they're going to contribute to the budget?
Well, they're quite short of money, because we're talking
okay,
about...
Okay, so you've got no financing at all.
I would have some financing. Michael Hoff is president of Hoff Productions, based in New York City and San Francisco, a media company best known for the series Hooked, Monster Fish, Weird, True and Freaky, Megastructures, and Man-Eating Super Croc.
Well, you aren't going to have a lot of locations for it, but you might find a home for it in the U.S.
It would be difficult, you think?
Yeah. I think the analogy is usually food. If you give people a buffet and it's fundamentally free, what are they going to eat? Do they go directly to the vegetables and say, mound those things up because I love broccoli? No, I mean, they tend to go to the stuff that's not necessarily that good for them.
There are many ways of cooking broccoli, though.
Yeah. If you did it the right way, they'd eat it. I think the bottom line is, if you want to cover this topic, I think you should cover it more from the point of aspiration versus desperation. And I don't think there's a big audience for television about just the suffering side of it. But I think you have to find compelling stories that other people empathize with. So if you find human stories of conquest over tragedy, of people overcoming the odds, and tell those stories, I think that might be more effective.
Yeah.
And by the way, I think the other problem is it's an immensely complex story. I could say to you, well, I want to do an 8-part series on curing cancer. Why aren't we doing that? That's a big deal, but it's a very complex story.
Well, we could be doing an 8-part series about curing cancer. Would that be easier to get on America? No, just as difficult.
Just as difficult.
You mean cancer and poverty are just as difficult?
I think so.
I don't disagree with you at all about aspiration, but I went to the largest slum near Johannesburg that is a kilometer away from the richest chunk of a city in the whole of Africa. Now, I met many people who had many great aspirations in this city, and I could go away and make a film about this, but I have to tell you their aspirations are in part blocked by the system. Are you saying to me that when you start to describe the system that blocks people, that's kind of a problem because it stops being about aspirations? I mean, poverty is about people being blocked from getting out of poverty, largely.
Yeah.
And that's not what people are especially interested in, you think?
I think that's fair.
Now,
Now, what concerns you about this, by the way?
Well, I'll tell you what concerns me.
I mean, you're a pretty sophisticated guy.
No, I'm not. Wait.
You're a sophisticated guy. No. You have complex emotions. You're a smart guy. And this all makes sense to you because you understand human nature. And anybody who works in the media has a pretty good sense of human nature because we've all had this constant feedback loop for what we put on the air and what people respond to. And I've been doing this, you know, long time, 3 decades. And the first thing you learn is once you start giving something to the audience is, oh, by the way, they aren't necessarily interested in what I'm interested in. That doesn't make them bad people.
No.
You know, there are books I read, they may not be interested. There are movies I like, but they aren't. And you have to start recognizing and respecting your audience. And they are a client in a way. And you are trying to educate them. You are trying to serve them. But you can't even affect them if they have the choice to walk away, and they choose to walk away.
It wasn't always that way. Back in the 60s, American TV ran in peak time a program called Harvest of Shame, presented by the celebrated journalist Ed Murrow and focusing on the plight of American agricultural workers. Around the same time, the New Yorker magazine ran an entire issue about poverty. I've always been fascinated by the failure of American television to communicate important things when it once did. It once sort of did. And I bumped into a small man called Lawrence Tisch, who was extraordinarily rich and owned CBS at the time. And I said to him that I had grown up loving the historic output of CBS, all the great news shows they did. And I said, why aren't you doing them now? Why can't you do them now? And he said, no, you really don't understand. What I do is not for people like you and me. It's for the little people. As it happens, we've managed, with the support of the BBC, to get the series off the ground. It's taken some doing, but we have been able to find some takers. Are they mad? Who is going to watch it? And are we reaching the audience we so desperately desire? Our first line of attack is the trailers for the series, adverts if you like. If the trailers don't work, then the people won't watch.
You see this book? This is only a woman's job. A man cannot do it. A woman has patience and time, and she will listen and learn. If you train a man, he wants to leave the village and go somewhere else looking for a job.
Solar Mamas is a documentary in the series which follows the Michael Hoff formula. It's a story of aspiration rather than desperation. The groundbreaking journey of one Bedouin mother living in Jordan who travels to India where she is trained to become a solar engineer.
Our solution is to train mothers and grandmothers. She might not know how to read and write. She might not ever have left a village, but in 6 months, we can make them into solar engineers and they can come back and solar electrify their own village.
The first one I saw was Solar Mamas, which completely inspired me, and I was really excited about it. I thought it was a great story as a narrative.
The trailers are the work of Sloane Clevin, one of the best film editors in the business.
That one I thought was really easy. Some of the other ones are hard because obviously
They're not about people trying to overcome things.
Right.
They're basically about why they can't overcome things.
Exactly. And they do a fantastic job of sort of showing how complicated it is to solve the problems of poverty in the world, but they don't pose any simple solutions. They're actually, a lot of the films show why a lot of the government policies and NGO policies have actually failed to solve the problem of poverty in so many places in the world. And so really what you need to do as a trailer editor is you need to appeal to people's curiosity about the world, and you need to appeal to their sense of compassion for other people.
My view is that you can make films that appeal to people's curiosity if you make them well enough, so that if they come across them, they'll go on watching them.
Yeah, it's hard to come across them in the United States. It's not part of our culture. You have to look for it. You have to really seek it out in America. So how to break through to a new audience is as much a mystery to me as somebody who supposedly works in marketing as it is to you.
But there is a huge tradition in America of wanting to know about the rest of the world and wanting to change the world. So right. if you leave documentaries to one side, you can't you tap into some adult educative impulse, some desire of people just to know about things?
Yeah, but I think there you need a lot of press. You need a lot of coverage in The New Yorker, The New York Times. You need a lot of press out in the world for people to find out about it and hear about it. You need a lot of social media. It's a slow, slow build, I think.
But getting journalists on traditional newspapers to write about poverty isn't any easier. The reason we've decided to launch our project, Why Poverty in New York, is because it's the venue for the United Nations Annual General Assembly, where the world's leaders gather for 1 week to address a series of global challenges. Poverty has to be high on the agenda. We're not the only ones getting in on the act. There's the former American president, Bill Clinton, too. I'm sitting in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, and I'm here attending the Clinton Global Initiative. This is something that Bill Clinton has run for several years now, and the annual membership fee is $20,000. The idea is that you tap American foundations to give money to good schemes, and thus you're involved in a kind of global redistribution. Most people look like they work on Wall Street for big, rich firms like Goldman Sachs, and indeed, probably many of them do. That's upstairs. The press are herded together in the basement where they pore over the communiques of corporate America. The few journalists I talk to don't seem to know what the story is or exactly why they are here. It all seems less about the poor and more about big business, charitable foundations, and who is funding whom. And even then, not much appears in the papers. What gets everyone excited in the end is when President Obama shows up, which at least gives reporters something to write about.
And I'm so proud to be in partnership with CGI to make this happen. Thank you very much, everybody.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Fareed Zakaria straddles both of these worlds. He's chaired one of the policy discussions during the Clinton Global Initiative, but especially, given his own background, is concerned to write about the poor.
Look, I grew up in India and my father was a politician and his constituency was 80% rural, so I have seen plenty of poverty and have even slept in those cots and spent days and days out in very remote places. But I think that writing about it, televising it, something that just gives people a sense of what it's like day to day, that's the piece we're missing. I think we have a fair degree of consensus on the grand policies at 30,000 feet, and they're right by and large. What we don't have is a sense of the urgency of helping these human beings now as they wait or work through the grand policy process and as their lives do improve in 10, 15 years. What can we do for them now?
I don't think that being poor is boring in the least. Personally, I view with great admiration the amazing, epic struggles of poor people. However, the view of editors or magazine readers. I mean, editors presume that these lives are boring. What do you say to editors to say, no, they're not boring at all, that if anything, just as interesting yeah. or more interesting than our lives?
This is actually a very interesting dilemma. There is a tendency for viewers, for readers, to switch off when they hear, oh my God, it's going to be another piece about poverty or another story about poverty. There's a sense in which they sort of feel like, A, I know about it and I don't want to be shamed or feel guilty. And also, there's a sense in which they want escapism. They don't want to be, you know, being told to eat spinach and broccoli at this point. But there's another part of it which is difficult, which is if you try to convey vividly the character of life for a poor person, what you quickly discover, having spent a bunch of time with very, very poor people in India, they're fascinating. They're just like us. Some of them are stupid, some of them are smart, some of them are funny, some of them are utterly humorless, some of them are wily, some are not. And when you convey the reality of that humanity, in a sense, they seem less victims. They seem less, you know, kind of basket cases who need to be helped. So by giving them the humanity that they deserve, you in a strange way reduce the urgency of having to help them. So my problem whenever talking about it and writing about it is to convey that the patronizing view that all poor people are miserable, bereft, and downtrodden is wrong, but they could still use a certain amount of material help.
So here we are in a world where people are looking for good news stories and where the system seems to work against the poor. And here I am, just another journalist making a documentary about making documentaries. Journalists are scared of being boring or unfashionable. And for most journalists, I suspect, nothing could be more boring or unfashionable than the lives of poor people.
Mozzie. Yes. I love it. Anybody want to take a picture with Mozzie right now?
Perhaps there are new ways of reaching out to people in the rich world and getting them interested in the poor.
Don't forget when you tweet and Facebook it, don't forget to put nothing but nets in the handle.
This is the Social Good Summit on 92nd Street in New York, another do-gooder event held during United Nations Week.
Speaking of social media,
its focus is on modern technology, using social media and the medium of the internet to link like-minded people and organizations. Aaron Sherinian is in charge of public relations and does a hard sell.
You've come to the right place, because what you're seeing right now is this combination of people who've got big ideas, big networks, and big bites, B-Y-T-E-S bites, of course, because this is really a great combination of folks.
Discussions are held about human rights, global sustainability, preventing genocide, and here and there, the subject of poverty, while scores of bloggers sit hunched over their laptops in a room upstairs, posting and tweeting to the world.
Social media is a way that we can take these issues and that we can break down the barriers that have impeded progress in the past. Social media allows us to connect, because everything we knew about how decisions are made and how we can cooperate and partner together, that all changed. And it changed when social media came on the scene.
One of those making an appearance is the blogger Maura Ahrens-Mehle, the founder of Women Online, aimed at mobilizing women over the internet.
The women in my world, in my community, are taking on their causes and using their huge megaphones to raise awareness. And what's different is that because of the incredible reach of social media and the fact that you've got this emerging class of influencers who talk to people every single day, you can talk about issues every day. You don't just have to wait until there's a crisis or a telethon to talk about the issue that's important to you. So I actually think it's a fantastic opportunity to bring aid and give voice to issues.
Do you feel that things you're interested in are poorly served by mainstream media? I mean, is it a case that you've sort of given up on radio, television, and what remains of newspapers, and you've gone into the web instead?
Oh, no, I think it's complementary. I mean, you know, bloggers, we don't exist to necessarily break news. We exist to amplify. When we find an issue that we really care about, we are really great at amplifying and letting other people know. And so hopefully it's a symbiotic relationship between the mainstream media and those of us in social media.
Everyone here is swimming in the same direction. I can't help feeling that all they are doing is recycling their views to people who are already engaged. Those in the rich world who've turned their backs on poverty will remain unaffected. And what the poor in parts of India or Africa would make of it all, I just don't know. Well, what do I feel about this gathering? First, it's like a physical incarnation of the internet. It's like a frenzied messaging system. There are people blogging or sending messages everywhere. And also, you get cornered by people who shove stuff into your hands, physically or metaphorically. They give you cards and they want you to pass on the cards to someone else. Second, I feel somewhat reluctantly that I don't want to be caught criticizing new media. There's something unfashionable about doing that. But I don't think we should be enthralled to techno illusions. I think we should be able to look at things and say, well, how do they help us? And when it comes down to poverty, I ask myself here, well, how does all this help the amelioration of poverty? Not very much, I'm inclined to think. In a converted loft in downtown Manhattan, I meet up with Alnor Lada, who is in the poverty business. He's co-founder of The Rules, a movement to address the root causes of poverty through direct action. He takes a skeptical view of efforts by the media to address the problem.
There is a culture of voyeurism and sentimentality that pervades Western media's coverage of poverty and inequality globally. It's a sort of storytelling ploy in order to elicit sympathy and viewership. It's not born from genuine concern and the belief that actually the media, by creating attention, will be able to help address and solve these problems, which is what essentially the role of media should be.
The wisdom of editors that I partly share is that you have something very sophisticated about trade or aid or inequality, and people just don't listen, unless it's deeply rooted in some human interest story that can be packaged and sold as news. You've lost people.
No, I think it's a false choice, right? I think the choice is not between a sensational human interest story or an abstract story about unfair trade or unfair tax, etc. I actually think you can use the same principles of great journalism, human interest story, starting with an individual, and just have a nuanced layer of nodding to, actually, there's this greater system beyond this. This isn't just some sort of fatalistic, deterministic thing that we should feel really sorry for these people. And I think that can still happen with the same type of great storytelling and sort of human interest, person-to-person narrative.
I would say that the last 3 years, considering these questions and how to get over the voyeurism factor, it seems to me the most difficult challenge of my journalistic life. Would you say that's probably correct? Or you think I'm just full of self-pity?
It is the toughest thing in the world because you're fighting against many fronts, right? You're fighting against a media conglomerate that is largely owned by a few people who have vested interests in not investing a lot of time and energy, etc., into this kind of detailed, nuanced reporting. You have the market, which, you know, I think there is an appetite. I think there's an increasing appetite, but it is an uphill battle, right? And creating quality, nuanced news that sort of addresses issues that, let's face it, people don't want to look in the mirror and realize that half the world's population is living under $2 a day and there's these massive structural issues. These are hard things to deal with, right? People want to read about how great the Olympics were.
Time now to reflect on my stay in New York over a drink outside one of the city's many bars. The writer Scott Fitzgerald once said to Hemingway about the rich that they were different. Yes, they have more money, Hemingway said. A poor individual has less money. That doesn't mean that his or her life is less interesting than ours, and it certainly doesn't mean that he or she matters less. There's no poverty silver bullet, and there's no media silver bullet. We, people like myself who work in the media, have to become more intelligent. We have to think outside cliché. It's true that we have to deal with poverty through the depiction of individual lives, but we also have to see the larger picture. It's all about public education, the greatest task of our century. Where will we be in 30 years' time unless we know what is happening to our world? And we have to hope that there will always be people willing to tell us the most uncomfortable things. I think there will be.